is today?
Okay, today is January the 7th, and this is a conversation with Tanachan Panyarada. The first thing I would like to talk about today, if you don't mind, is a little bit about Chankama, about the walking meditation. Mm. It seems evident to me that Chankama in the Forest Dhamma tradition is a very important part of the meditation. Well, first of all, what would you say is the crucial importance, the main fact in the walking meditation?
Well, there are several points that are very important. So the first is that of suitability. Some people find it much more suitable to walk and do meditation, sit. And if a person finds that it works much better for them, then that's what they should do. They should use whichever method they find helps their meditation practice the most. It doesn't mean to say it will always be like that, because as one does the practice, one learns and changes. As one changes, it's possible that the sitting meditation practice may come back better. Or for another person that they're used to sitting, and then they find walking helps. And this can change from time to time, or can change only after quite a long time. It depends on the character of the person inside. That's the first importance, really. The second thing is that you can't sit all the time. You've got to have some other posture which is going to sort of keep the body in order, keep it feeling in reasonable shape. And the walking kind of process is very useful for that. It gives exercise, it gives a different posture which one can alternate with the sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it's necessary to have things like the walking practice to do, if one can do it. Thirdly, I would say that with some people, particularly if their minds are rather restless, to do the activity of walking can help to calm them down. Because the restlessness is sort of absorbed by the walking. And then that leaves the mind free to go into some form of meditation practice.
You said because it's absorbed by the walking.
In other words, the restlessness of the mind has got itself full with the process of walking.
It's got itself?
It's got a full task.
Oh, yeah.
With controlling
yes,
the body in the process
right.
of walking.
So it's helped by that.
And any restlessness that's there will tend to be sort of overlaid by the walking.
Yes.
And that then can free the mind to other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people, they like working with their hands, and they're doing things, and they don't have to be specially thinking very much about that. And if they're doing that, then their minds are free to think about, to contemplate things and practice.
So in this case, you would have two things. On the one hand, the activity of walking, and then on the other hand, on the other side, the mind being free to contemplate a meditation object.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Or if one likes to contemplate the walking itself. There's no reason why one shouldn't. I mean, this is a process that's going on that involves the body,
mm-hmm.
and one can get some very useful results from it, no doubt about it.
Yes, using the walking as
yes.
a ramana, as the object.
Yes.
Would this, of course, this varies according to people. Someone can use the walking, someone can use budo.
Yes.
Wouldn't you say so?
Yes.
That
yes.
the object
yes.
would vary.
Yes, it would vary, but one doesn't have to keep one's attention on the walking.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I mean, if one goes onto Bud Hole, the probability is that if you're walking, one will just leave that to take care of itself.
The walking.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And the Bud Hole then will absorb the attention
mm-hmm.
of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, with some, I know with some, they've gone doing meditation practice on the walking, and they got so absorbed in what they're dealing that they walk off right into the jungle.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly find themselves in a bush or something like that.
Because they were too much absorbed.
Yeah.
Other
times, a person doing the walking practice, and they may get absorbed, and they just stop, and they don't even know they've stopped.
Stop walking.
Yes, it's the mind goes deep.
Yes.
Stop.
In any case, as usual, here too, there's no hard and fast rule.
No. This is up to the individual to do and find out for themselves what works.
Also, according to a number of factors, like. Also, if someone has been meditating for a number of years,
yes.
That's different from someone who's just beginning to do the chankama, right?
Oh, yes. Hmm. Yes, because the person who's done it a long time, they'll know the different modes of walking, the different things you can do, and they can then adapt that to the conditions of the moment,
right.
So that it can be useful.
Mm-hmm. And if you had to teach a beginner, you would tell him her try and see what
try,
what
see,
what's
yeah,
best
yeah.
And what the possibilities are. You would probably mention two or three possibilities, like walking in Budo, for instance.
Yes, that. Mm. Or keeping the attention on the walking.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, those are things a person should try for himself.
Yes.
One thing that I would say here, one shouldn't get thinking, as I think some people are likely to, that if your attention isn't on the walking, you're not being mindful. It's not so.
Mm-hmm.
Because mindfulness is, the true mindfulness is an awareness in the citta of whatever sensations are received by the citta.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the person, this is, mind you, to get to that is a difficult task, and it's rare that people do get it. Sometimes they might, but it's a rare thing. But if while doing the walking practice, one's attention is on Buddha, then that is the thing that's occupying the mind. And in that form of practice, one leaves the walking just to take care of itself. If, however, one makes the walking the object of practice, then one's attention should be on that.
In other words, the degree of mindfulness is measured by the how much you are being with Budo in the first case, or how much you're being with the walking in the second case.
Yes.
It is not that since you are not being with the walking, you are not being mindful.
Yes. No, one shouldn't think that.
No.
I mean, one might say perhaps that one's not being perfectly mindful,
mm-hmm.
but then how many people are doing the practice?
Mm.
It's a good practice. The thing is, it's quite possible again that if one becomes perfectly mindful on Buddha, one will stop walking. Just automatically.
Stops
stand.
Walking.
Yes, just stand.
Because it's totally,
like,
totally absorbed into Buddha.
Yeah, becomes too absorbed.
Mm.
I can think of a comparable thing to this. If you are driving a car, and you have a passenger with you, and you're talking. You're talking with the passenger, and suddenly you come to a very busy intersection. The car's going all over the place, and you have to find your way through it. You just stop listening completely,
mm-hmm.
and even if the person talks, you don't know what they say.
Mm-hmm.
The mind's become completely absorbed in that one thing.
In that search,
and
for
it stops. Stops the listening altogether. Later on, when I've got through, when I can relax and go, what are you saying?
Mm.
But it shows how the mind, when it does become absorbed, it just goes straight in there and stops all other activity.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way, it's quite possible that if one's doing Buddha and one became absorbed in that way,
mm-hmm.
the walking would stop.
Because it will be extra, so to speak. That,
yes, it's something.
One more thing.
Because, I mean, the walking does require a certain background of attention. But if one became fully absorbed, even that would be absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff.
Yes. A few days ago, when I first arrived, we had a short chat, and I think we mentioned the very slow walking Burmese style.
Yes.
And you said something about Thanachan having a certain reservation about this style.
He's never, as far as I know, he's never said that one shouldn't do. Because, I mean, again, some people might find this useful to them. And if they do, well, so well and good, do it by all means. But he doesn't like it as a general...
as a must.
Yeah, as a must in practice at all. Because part of the reason for doing walking practice is to train oneself to be mindful where everyone is and everyone's walking. And if you train yourself while doing slow walking, it's not so easy to get that to operate when you're doing fast walking or just walking normally.
Yes, that's right. It's true.
And the training there is rather limited to the one type of walking.
It's true. My experience is that it can be very helpful, but certainly it's a very specific object of concentration.
Because if you're walking that slowly, it's not a natural form of walking.
No, you cannot
walk naturally. Because the dynamics of walking are stopped. You're almost a sort of static walking, if you can call it that.
Yes. On the other hand, different speeds can help, and sometimes...
It's interesting, once I read something of Gurdjieff, I don't know who used to say him. He once said that to be mindful, although he didn't call it mindfulness, I forget what he called it, maybe he was paying attention. To be mindful, if one's having difficulty, then one should do an activity faster than normal or slower than normal.
To bring the tenderness alive. That's a good point.
It's quite an interesting hint, actually.
One might say that in the Burmese style, there is only one type of advice: that do it slow, more slowly rather than fast.
I have used that method, and it's certainly useful for developing calm. I don't know if I got much insight from it.
From the slow walk?
I don't think so. But it certainly developed calm, and I found it to some extent useful. But from what I've seen now, I would say that the normal walking practice is normal speed. It's better to do.
But when you do normal speed, the aramana varies?
Yes. But after all, if you're walking slowly and you keep your mind more intent on every movement, you're taking much longer on every movement, and the amount of concentration per second or per minute, if you like, I don't think is different from that if you're walking at normal speed. Normal speed, things are going very much faster.
No,
you
I
can't
agree.
Perhaps be so precise.
Yes. No, I agree with that. The only thing I was wondering about is that if you keep a normal speed, you might just stay with your stepping without trying to be specially precise. The important thing is that you are mindful of your normal walking.
Yes. What is important, I think, with any of the practices, whether you do it fast or slow, is that when you get used to keeping your mind on the walking, then you do try to become more precise, more exact as to the process. Because there are all sorts of details left out. Actually, you can see this on the Anapanasati practice. They put it quite well in also the Visuddhimagga. How the person to begin with is either aware the end of the out-breath or the end of the in-breath. The person who is more aware is aware of both the end of the out-breath and the end of the in-breath. But the way that one should do it is to become aware not only of the end, but the whole way through the breath.
Beginning, middle, and end.
Right the way through. All the way through. Mm-hmm. In other words, to begin with, one catches just parts of it, like that.
Mm-hmm.
As one becomes more skilled and realizes one's got to go into more detail, you've got to pin onto much more of it. And then when one can do that, then one has to go even more detail. Until one's got the whole thing.
Oh, this is an important point.
Keep the mind entirely on the track.
Mm-hmm. The steadier you become, and then the deeper and the more into the whole process you can bring yourself.
Yes.
In other words, the calmer your mind becomes, and the more you can go into being attentive of the whole, for instance, walking.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one can say that whatever practice one does, one has got to learn to put everything into it.
Mm-hmm.
Memory, thought, consciousness, feeling, the whole lot has got to be in that practice.
Mm.
The whole thing.
Well, this is very important. I'm sure that an addict, so to speak, to the Burmese style would immediately say, but the slow walking would make this precise attention easier.
Well, if he thinks like that, then it's up to him to do that, and that's all.
Mm.
I mean,
yes.
But the thing is, a lot of people have found it's not very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And not some have found it successful, maybe.
Yes.
It's really up to them. If they don't agree and they like to do it their way, well, that's up to them.
Oh, yeah, no, this is not the point. I was just wondering, you are saying, basically, this is what interests me, that even while keeping a normal pace, you can be extremely precise.
Oh, yes, you can.
That this is the important thing, definitely.
Yes. Mm. The thing is, what one's trying to do is force the attention down into the chitta all the time. Because the mindfulness can only be real mindfulness when it's in the chitta.
In the chitta. So the walking, whether slow or fast, is a device, right?
Yes.
It's just an anchor to help you keeping the mind inside.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather like if you've got a telephone system where you've got the exchange at the centre and you've got the lines going out. It gets, if you have to go out to every subscriber to get the message every time, it gets rather tiresome.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the middle there, you can get them all straight into one place.
In the middle
whatever
the
happens, it all comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with the mindfulness. If the mindfulness is going out to the sensations all the time, it gets rather tiresome, jumping about.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult, and then you miss bits. You know.
Right.
But if you're in the center, whatever comes in through the center, it's all there.
Mm-hmm. Mm. This is very crucial, and makes me think of the second question I wanted to ask you, and it's about appamada. Appamada?
Yes.
I think the last words of the Buddha were appamadena sampadeta. So appamada is usually translated with diligence,
yes.
With caring. I think right effort belongs to that category of appamada.
Oh, yes.
Now, I find the Forest Dhamma teaching very refreshing, and so I was now trying to have a better look into the concept of right effort. In May and June, I was exposed to the teaching of Upandita Sayadaw from Burma, and he would give a Dhamma talk every night, and many of his talks were about appamada, about mindfulness. And one of the key words, at least in English, I don't know in the original Burmese, was meticulousness. The advice, the encouragement, the suggestion was for the mindfulness of the meditators to be extremely meticulous in covering the entire object that one was asked to be mindful of. So I have some problem with the word meticulous, and I wonder whether they know exactly the import.
I wouldn't disagree with that, certainly.
You would not?
I wouldn't disagree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's correct. But to be meticulous here, one has to be a little careful what people are going to interpret.
Exactly.
To be meticulous in the sense of thinking of it and noticing everything, if it is in the right way, it's all right. But if it's in the wrong way, it's not. The wrong way I describe is like this, where you've got the object there, and then you deliberately start looking, well, what is there about this object? And then you sort of work out, well, it's this, 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 this. If one acts in that way, it just leads to distraction.
So you are being curious.
It breaks the whole thing up.
Mm.
It's even a sort of deliberate process of trying to be meticulous, which defeats itself.
Mm.
But it's the ego coming in.
Self. It's ego.
Yes, self coming. I want to know.
Mm.
Whereas if one has trained oneself to be careful, and when anything comes up like that, to question it, to see in terms of, is this something good or bad?
What would you question in this case?
Well, first of all, is this something good or bad? Is it something valid? Is it something helpful?
The wanting to be meticulous, for instance.
Yeah, well, I mean, in this case, one is very careful to choose the object and see, well, what sort of object is this? Is this something that's going to help me or not? Is it something good or bad? Is it something I should allow inside or not?
Mm. Not blindly.
Yeah, not
so
blindly.
If one tries to be meticulous in a blind...
One's wide open.
All right.
It's really like that.
Mm.
One keeps an awareness of the whole thing, a readiness to respond, so that anything that happens there, one knows straight away. But it doesn't mean that one's sort of saying, this is green. This looks very, very bright. This is whatever it is, you know, picking on the factors like that. It's the way a sort of child is trying.
Mm. You would say that is not right effort. That is wanting to be good, wanting to show.
Making oneself feel that one's doing what's right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's important. Because
this is a sort of play, make-believe practice that some people do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mostly dull people who do this.
They must?
Mostly dull people.
Mm-hmm.
People who are full of
Doha.
And they can never get on in the practice. It's because of this. Instead of standing back, so to speak, and looking, and making one's mind quiet and calm, they're trying to get into it, and all the time looking. And when they look, their mind is just a blank. It's no, there's nothing in it, nothing valid, nothing really good at all.
Excellent.
I don't know if that describes.
No, that makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, the other day you were when. Talking about right effort, you mentioned precision as one dimension of it. Would you say something else in terms of how could the right effort be explained in a full way? I think it's one of the key of the Buddhist attitude.
When one is putting forward right effort, I mean, this will be in the practice, certainly in some form or other. Having done it, it's a good thing to review it. Not to question to oneself, is there in some way I should have done it better? Did I really find out what the truth of this was that I was doing? What were the states that I was in? And then one makes the resolve next time to try and be more aware.
Mm-hmm.
So that one knows these things.
So this is a way of helping right effort. You review the quality of your effort after a period of practice, basically.
Yes, generally, to try and be more precise when you're actually doing the practice, you can't. You can't do it, because unless that is, there's a lot of distraction. There's distraction there, and then the thing is to try and notice that and just cut that out. But other than that, it's difficult to do much when you're actually in the practice. It's too close.
That's right.
So the only thing one can do is afterwards to review it, think about it.
And the key questions you said were, how did I do it? Was I aware enough?
Yes. And also to try and search out how much of my mind was actually on the practice and how much of elsewhere. Often there are thoughts going on in one's mind, almost like dream thoughts, which one forgets immediately. And if one searches, one can often find those. And one can find that one's mind was on something entirely different. You hadn't realized it at all.
But in retrospect, you can.
Sometimes, if one searches, but if one doesn't search, it's like a dream, you forget it. And it's like a dream also in that if one searches for what the content of a dream was, one can get to one can remember it.
One can
get back to it.
Yes.
Recall it.
But what you are pointing out is that the importance of being aware of those dreamlike thoughts. Because,
yes.
For instance,
yes.
In certain periods of the day or in long retreats, I personally can have quite a lot of dreamlike thoughts.
Yes.
And there is not much I can do to cut them or eliminate them. But the idea is to know that they are there.
If you know them, then you learn to watch them. That will cut them automatically in time. Because the knowing them stops them being dreamlike.
Oh, I've seen that they've been diminishing over the years remarkably. Yeah. So this is precious, right? Effort, a way of deepening right effort being the reviewing of the practice in retrospect afterwards.
Yes, it's very important to review the practice, certainly. Search into one's practice and think, well, what am I doing wrong? Why don't I get deeper? Why do I find it difficult to attain calm? Or to attain to a state of samadhi or panya, for that matter. And then one has to review this and sort of find out and search for what the causes are. And this will, in itself, point out how one should be more careful, how one should be more precise in the practice.
Or you might find out that you need some help, for instance, that you're...
Yes, you may. Yes. I mean, if there's a teacher or somebody who can help, then that may be the best thing to do, just the teacher. Tanachan used to say that in his practice he got problems coming up. He didn't know how to answer them. And he would go to Tanachan Man. And Tanachan Man would give him 10 minutes talk and just solve them that way. Sort of way, every time. He said it was quite remarkable. If he hadn't had Tanachan Man's help, it would have taken him a long time to solve some of those problems. He would probably have done it, but it would have taken him a long time.
My good teacher.
Yes.
You said you might see that for some reason you don't get into a state of panya or in a state of samadhi. When you say a state of panya, what do you mean? Understanding?
Supposing one is doing the contemplation of the body. Now one goes through hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, fingers, bones, stones, parts like that. You go through each one of them. Maybe you visualize it. Maybe you put your mind at the location of the part. Different ways of doing it. I mean, one does it in whatever way one does. But at the same time, that doesn't turn into panya just like that. When one does that, it's not panya. This is a training for panya. It isn't panya. Panya comes when you suddenly see it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I would put it, it's the seeing of the implications of it. In other words, skin. Well, skin, we know it's there, and it's necessary to life. If the body didn't have it, we would die, or sort of thing. We know perfectly well. We know it's only very thin. It's a material that rubs off all the time, and replaced from underneath. We know all this. But the implications of skin, as far as self is concerned, what is this skin? And then if one can realize that it's just part of this world. It's come from this world, it goes back to the world.
This isn't
me.
Mm-hmm.
It's got nothing to do with me. I mean, how could that be me? It's almost as though one has to get up a rather vague idea of what I think I am. And then you put skin. It really is the same thing. And it's almost then, if one can do that, and the implication of it is seen, then you get the wisdom. And that's the state of wisdom.
Seeing is different from thought about.
Right? Yes, it's not merely thinking about.
Right.
It's a knowing what its nature is. It's a knowing of that is not self. It couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
It's got no relation to self. I mean, it's no more self than old rotten bit of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever self is.
Pardon me?
Whatever self is.
So more like an intuitive knowledge rather than thinking.
It's a direct knowing. It's a direct knowing almost. There isn't any way of explaining it really to say exactly what it is. Because the only time one can come across this in ordinary life, I think, is when there's some catastrophe or something happens.
Mm.
And one's view of the situation and what's involved in that situation changes radically at the time.
Right.
It goes deep home, deep in. And one sees the implications of it, one sees what it means. I mean, you see in a road accident, there's people dead on the ground. And at that moment, death has a completely different meaning to one from what it used to.
Mm-hmm.
But there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one knows that person just 5 minutes ago, he's alive. You know, he's dead now. Look. You know, and how do I know that I wasn't that person?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's really full appreciation of the implications of what's going.
The state of panya is directly connected with the state of samadhi.
No, the state of samadhi is the ground from which panya can arise easily.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't arise unless the person does the work to develop the panya.
To develop?
You've got to develop panya, much in the same as you have to do work to develop samadhi.
Yeah, in other words, this is important. You are saying you cannot expect that simply because of the fact that you've developed samadhi, out of it automatically panya comes.
No, that doesn't happen. No.
You have to develop both.
You have to develop both, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they're almost in opposite directions. The panya is tending to break up the calm, if anything. Whereas the samadhi is tending to lull one away from any wisdom.
Mm.
And it's only when those two can get together in a harmonious manner that the results become very fast and well.
Is there anything that one can do in order to effect this harmonious conciliation
only
of two opposites?
Simply by following the practice of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing does that.
For instance, alternating samadhi practice and panya practice would be
No,
skillful.
I would say that to begin with, one has to do a lot more on the samadhi practice to begin with. Most people, I don't say everybody, but most people have to do far more on the samadhi practice. But they shouldn't neglect panya at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They should try to develop some panya as well.
So would it be correct, the way what I try to do myself is that formal practice, 90% is samadhi practice, when I sit or walk, I do anapana.
Yeah.
When I'm not doing formal practice, I try to investigate. Or
yes.
When I am doing formal practice and something strong comes up, then I try to investigate. Would you say that this is a balance?
Yes, in general I'd say that's all right. If something strong comes up in the practice, it will depend on its nature. What one has to realize is if something happens which is tending towards the development of calm, of samadhi, and then you use panya to research that, it can break it up.
It can?
Can break it up.
Can break the...
Yes, it's as though it's sort of breaking it apart to see what it is. And that can spoil the thing.
In other words,
it can do at times, but one has to be careful.
If you see that what's happening is helpful for your samadhi and you want to develop samadhi, then let it happen.
Yeah, let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if one's doubtful and one's uncertain, or is this the right way or the wrong way or anything like that, then one must turn to panya.
Mm-hmm. Going into panya meaning into satipanya.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I have something in mind. This is a passage from Panatan which struck me very much, and I wonder whether you feel like saying something about it. He says, the Dhamma tends to arise in places where things are lacking, in difficult places where we are cornered, at the end of our rope. It doesn't arise where things are overflowing, where our needs are met.
Yeah. Now, at the end of our rope, the actual idiom should be at the end of one's tether. I don't know why he's put that in.
Does it make a big difference in English, say?
Yes, it's a very peculiar, it sounds very peculiar at the end of one's rope.
Oh, yes.
I don't know why he should change that, I don't know. Because the ordinary English idiom is that kind of untelling.
Yes.
Yes, that's quite true, of course. When things are nice and comfortable and easy, the tendency is to do the practice in a half-hearted way. It does a bit and then I think, oh, I've done enough now, some more later on. And never gets very far. When a person is under pressure, things are difficult, then they turn to the practice as a refuge. Then they can really do some good, because they need it. They've got to do something. And often it can go quite well. In special circumstances it can often go well, where a person's they're very uncertain about the future. They don't know what's going to happen. They can't stay in the place where they are. They have to leave, they have to go, they don't know where they're going to go, they don't know how they're going to get there. And things are very difficult like that. Then in those circumstances they can turn to the practice and go deep into it often. Because there's a need.
In such circumstances?
Yes, because there's a need. A need for it. Or when they're in times of war, for instance, or in times of turmoil and trouble, then there's often periods when the practice can go quite well. Or alternatively, one can take the monk who deliberately goes off to the jungle to find difficult places. Tanchan speaks of at least one monk that he knew who would deliberately go and find where tigers walk. Path that they would walk on. And he'd go and sit himself down just by the side of that path. And it was as though then he knew that he'd got to get into samadhi. It had that effect on the citta, and when it was like that, it went easy.
He might have chosen also, I guess it depended on his practice, to go into pani rather than into samadhi.
No, in this case...
Investigating fear.
No? Samadhi, really. Mm. No, fear, that also is used. But the investigation in that case, it's hard to say whether it's panya or samadhi. I think it's a combination of the two when it comes up. Such a case. There was a case of one, he gives the case of a man who... Because he was walking Shankaran up and down, and then suddenly he heard tiger roar just by the side of the path there, and he saw it there, great big one too, just squatting down there, and he was so terrified, he didn't know what to do. He just stopped and stood, and for a long time he couldn't sort of gather his thoughts.
He what?
He couldn't gather his thoughts, and then the idea came to him, really speaking, this tiger, it has a citta, I have a citta, it has a body, I have a body. It has dukkha, I have dukkha. We're both the same in this. And with that, he starts to calm down. And when he started to calm down, he went into samadhi very, very easily. And when he came out, he felt we were friends with the tiger. And he went and he was gone by then. He went looking for it, couldn't find it. Just as well, perhaps. but under circumstances like that, the citta is forced into it.
So the Dhamma tends to arise in places where things are lacking, in difficult places.
Yes.
Because of this pressure that you were mentioning.
Yes.
Plus, however, saddha, because I can be in a very difficult situation.
Yeah.
But if I don't have faith, and any motivation to practice, the difficulty can just be overwhelming. And
that's true. Yes. He's talking here, of course, about the people who have already developed a lot of that anyway, and who've done a lot of practice. This isn't for the person who's just beginning.
Yes. No, that's obvious. Using this also to make some reflection about the importance of saddha.
Yeah, it is important. Yeah. Yeah, saddha is very important. The fact that there are a lot of factors necessary. But the thing is, he's mentioning here the thing that many people don't recognize, and that is the value of having difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Having a location where it's difficult. People going off to the forest and living in the forest and having to walk a long way for pindapata and then getting very little food, it's difficult.
Yes, yes.
And this is part of the training.
Mm. On the other hand, once a person has developed the Dhamma inside, wouldn't you say that even if he or she is in a relatively comfortable situation, the practice doesn't tend to be half-hearted anymore, but actually he or she can take advantage of the comfortable and peaceful situation to go deeper into the practice?
On this I would say that to a certain extent it's true, but the person must have had must have developed quite a long way in the Dhamma to be able to do that.
Must have developed a lot in the Dhamma to be able to take advantage of an easy situation.
Yes.
Hmm.
It's rather on the lines of Tanachan's teaching about middle way. When one has a lot of kilesas.
When
one has a lot of kilesas.
Yes.
Then one has to use a lot of rough methods to correct them. When those methods have had their effect, then the kilesas are more subtle. Well, what's left is more subtle. You have to use more subtle ways of correcting them. As they get more and more subtle, the necessity for very rough and difficult environments gets less. With most people, but I mean, one can't be sure. There may be some people
who
feel vary so much, one can't tell. But this is probably the case. On the other hand, it will depend what one means by a suitable or an easy situation. I mean, if we've had an easy situation where there was food available, I mean, good food, but not necessarily too much. Where it was very quiet, peaceful, where you didn't have to bother about other things very much, and you could do them, just stay there and do the practice, then that would be a good situation.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
That sort of situation, yes. That can be. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's good for a practitioner.
Yeah.
For another person, would be a nightmare, probably.
Yes.
Because, on the other hand, if a situation is good in the sense that it's full of input, of distractions, then that would be challenging for meditators, wouldn't it? Because you should look that the mind doesn't get sucked in all those inputs.
Yes, although it doesn't usually help. Very, very few people does it help. It's nearly always harmful.
In other words, they better avoid such challenges.
Yeah. The challenges like that. Well, there may be people who would then look on it as a challenge and would fight it, and it may help them. Because there are all sorts of people.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, it's harmful.
It's dangerous,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So better, a more secluded...
I mean, to give an example, a person whose mind becomes more subtle, they become more sensitive. And they just have to hear a bit of music on the radio, not their own, I mean with another one, so in another house perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes in, they have quite a while getting that out of it. It takes quite a while before that stops coming up in their mind.
Well, it's true. I've noticed that since
I mean, it's when you've got that sort of thing, it's a terrible nuisance.
But wouldn't you say this is, I think, an important point? Through the practice, one becomes more sensitive.
Yes.
But isn't it true that, in addition to becoming more sensitive, one somehow, I hope at least, becomes also stronger? Because I've noticed that myself, that I'm certainly more sensitive after years of practice that I was before, than I was before.
It's true, one becomes stronger. But the thing is, it's far better if one can use that strength to dealing with one's own problems than having to deal with it, use it to deal with sort of things that are artificial or that come in from outside.
Yes, in other words, spending energy to protect oneself.
Yeah, it's increasing the task.
It's increasing the task, yes.
Yes. Generally, nearly all those who practice, they say, get to a quiet place. It's good. Noisy, disturbed places are really bad.
Yes. Well, no, the only thing one can say is that unfortunately, unless you are a monk, not always you can choose a quiet place. So when you have to be in a noisy place, you need all your dhamma to face it, don't you think? Like living in a city and having to deal with a lot of people, and then what I try to do is to remind myself of all the dhamma that I learned.
Well, in a case like that, one can just sort of mark time. And try and hold against it as much as one can. But as far as developing in that, it's difficult.
No. I see what you mean. I'm not implying that you go into a traffic jam in order to develop yourself or your samadhi.
You
try to avoid traffic jams.
Yes.
But once you are there. I think it's important to take a very active dhammic attitude rather than just pray that the situation ends as soon as possible, right?
Yes. No, I mean, obviously one must try and do what one can. in that situation, whatever situation one's in. But it's better if one can avoid it.
Definitely. Yes. It's like, on the other hand, makes me think of illnesses.
Yes.
One has to, you know, to do all the best to be as healthy as one can. But once the illness strikes,
yes,
then it can be a powerful tool for our practice.
Yes. It's like that old Jim Lord now. When he was sick, he was a monk as monk should be. When he was well, a devil a monk was he.
Devil?
A devil a monk was he. So it's an old Christian saying. I don't know where it comes from.
The song implied that it's better if...
Well, I mean, when he was sick, he was very sorry for himself, and he sort of prayed and did all the
meek
things he should.
Right.
But once he got well, mm-hmm, he was up to all sorts of tricks.
Yes. One last thing, if you don't mind, just briefly for today. The other day we talked a little bit about Satipani. If you had to say just a few essential things about Satipani and the four Satipatthanas, what would you say, unless you think that it's better to postpone this question?
Well, the four Satipatthanas are really the field of Satipanya. The field is, because four Satipatthanas deal with body, feeling, citta, dhammas.
Right.
And this is the field in which the Satipanya must be used.
Mm-hmm.
Satipanya is used in body, the first one, because it's the most gross, it's the most obvious. Some people find it valuable to use feeling as well, or to examine the citta, its nature, or to go into dhammas.
When you say go into dhammas, you mean the five nivaranas and four noble truths?
Yes,
you can say
the dhammas mean the underlying principles. The underlying principles of what we are and what life is.
Oh, I see. So you don't mean it in a sense, about this.
If one looks at it carefully, one will find that the four noble truths, all the different factors from that, the five khandhas, the 37, isn't it? Bodhipakya Dhammas.
Yes, they all are the underlying principles.
They are the underlying principles.
Mm-hmm.
And one can go into those. But they're very subtle. And the usual place to start is body.
Yes.
Because that's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can also, it's said, if one sees one of these things properly, one will see the other.
One of this.
If one sees one part of the body truly, the whole lot becomes bad.
Yes.
You don't have to go through every part. One bit is enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'll ask for more next time, for the time being.
Right there.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Okay, today is January the 9th, and this is a conversation with Tanachan Tanyavaddo. Talking about the very crucial issue of the kilesas, what would you say about sadness and kilesas? Would you say that sadness is a kilesa? Would you say that all forms of sadness are kilesa, or maybe some of them are, or some of them are not?
if one gets sad, it usually means that something has happened that is unpleasant, that one dislikes, one doesn't want. Now this may be a good thing or a bad thing, but one doesn't want it. It has gone contrary to what one's used to. It's gone contrary to what one's accepted, and plans or one's outlook on the world or people or whatever it happens to be. Now, to the extent that one's got a fixed idea, that comes from Kilesa, of course, that one hasn't accepted change. I mean, it's said when the Buddha died that bhikkhus who had not attained arahantship, they were very sorry. Those who had, there's no sorrow. Mm-hmm. They just accepted. Because of that, one can say, yes, there are kilesas there, to some extent. There must be kilesas involved in it. At the same time, one mustn't look on a state of sadness or sorrow as necessarily a bad thing. Because if the sorrow comes from such as one sees the body, and when one sees the body, one sees what it is. And one sees that it's contrary to what one's always accepted, contrary to one's fond illusions. That it isn't the high and important thing one's made it out to be in the past. Then a state of sorrow can come up, a state of disillusionment.
You've now, been seeing that the body decays.
Seeing it like that, yes, yes. But this sorrow comes up because it's the dukkha of having to give way to the truth. And the self, which involves kilesas, of course, is then frustrated. And it's diminished. So there's a feeling of dukkha, if we interpret as sorrow. Mm-hmm. To that extent, one would say kilesas are definitely involved, but the state itself isn't necessarily a bad state. It may be just an inevitable result of something that is quite good that's happened or happening.
Mm-hmm. And therefore you would not deal with it the same way you would deal with anger, for instance.
Yes. If, however, the sorrow occurs to a state where one's incapacitated, then you can say there's kilesas there.
If the state of sorrow
makes one sort of incapacitated, where you can't do anything, mm-hmm. where the person can't think of anything else, mm-hmm. then they've gone too far, and that's kilesas coming up. Mm-hmm. It's there, I would say, there's an attempt to try and recoup the situation, and not to accept.
Recoup? What do you mean by recoup?
Recoup, to recoup self. To get back to self as it was before.
I see. No,
Instead of giving way. And realizing that this is gone. We can't cling on.
The situation that you described, the total paralysis, would be due to the fact that there is total non-acceptance of something.
Yes.
So you are closing up and trying to
hold on.
To hold on and have things stay the same.
Yes.
Totally unrealistically.
Yes.
Sometimes you don't know the cause of the wave of sadness.
Yeah.
Would you say that the only thing, or the one thing which counts in terms of right practice, right effort, is not feeding it,
Yeah, when it comes, the best thing to do is to accept it as dukkha. And to realize that this dukkha has come about because one's had wrong understanding, wrong views. It's because of the fundamental wrong views and the outlook that one's had in the past, this has come about at all. this is sadness.
Mm-hmm.
If that hadn't been there, it couldn't come.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a reflection which helps. And then in terms of practicing, of course, being with the parikanna helps, not to feed the mood.
Yes, it's really what's required there is a state of acceptance, which means that when it arises, one knows it's arisen, one accepts it, and one goes on doing what has to be done in the world, just as one normally does, regardless. In other words, one takes no account of that sadness insofar as it may try to inhibit one from doing things.
Yes. Well,
one just goes ahead and does whatever needs doing, and that's it. And one says, all right, well, this is a Nietzsche also.
Yes, so suppose you are in a retreat. You go ahead and meditate.
Yes, go on, yes.
And stick to your parikamma, for instance.
Yes, yes.
This seems to be the best policy, maybe.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this regard, there are a couple of things by Tanachan, with to me there are statements which seem crucial to me. It says, our investigation of pain is for the purpose of separating the mind from the pain, so that if not entangled in pain, so that it is not entangled in pain, so that whenever pain arises, the mind doesn't cling to the pain as being itself. And somewhere else, he says the citta is not dukkha, which seems to be a condensed statement to the same effect.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mind here, of course, means citta.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that the citta itself is not the pain, it's not the dukkha. The dukkha of pain is a parameter, if you like. It's a factor that arises and dies away. Because it arises and dies away, it's not the citta. It's separate. And one has to examine. Normally we think there is dukkha. I have dukkha. In fact, we almost say, I am dukkha this time. Now, what do we have? We have dukkha as one thing, we have the I or self as we think as another, the two are identified. What we have to try and do is separate them, see, compare the dukkha, compare what I believe to be myself. And see, well, this that I think of as myself, and this dukkha, in what way are they identified?
What I think to be myself and dukkha.
Yes. Mm-hmm. To see whether that self that one thinks, which is identified with the dukkha, is a real thing or not.
Maybe one doesn't find anything.
Possibly not, but one has to try to search to find out, well, all right, if this dukkha is here, who has the dukkha? What has the dukkha?
Right.
What knows this dukkha? What is affected by it?
For instance, what knows the dukkha seems to be the citta, and the citta keeps knowing it, so it doesn't seem to be it, right?
It knows it, but it isn't. It shouldn't be affected by it. The ephemeral citta, the citta as khandas, of course, is affected by it. But that's the... Well, that's a similar idea. That's the waves on the ocean, which can be of all sorts of shapes and forms.
Right.
But the real nature of the citta, one has to look at and see, well, this that is underlying all the time.
The citta.
Yeah, the citta here. Well, this and this dukkha, in what way are they the same thing?
No, it seems to me that they're not the same,
yeah.
because dukkha comes and
yeah.
goes, and that the faculty of knowing is constantly there.
Yes.
But I feel that if I think in this case of citta in terms of awareness that facilitates my practice, I can see the difference between a vedana, dukkha, which a painful sensation which comes and goes, and the awareness which is there. And which seems to be different from it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's a good thing to keep on to that, to see that difference between the two.
Yes, because otherwise citta, I might fall into the trap of using citta as a concept, as an idea.
Yes, yes, yes.
But citta is the knowing, isn't it?
It's the one who knows.
Constantly.
Yeah.
So awareness is citta.
Yeah. It's like somebody asked, well, someone was talking about the citta one night to Kanachan, the layperson. And he wants to know what the citta was. So Kanachan took his flashlight and he was showing it. And he said, when you see something of that sort, that light there, he said, that's not the citta.
He pointed to something.
Well, he was saying this person was talking about the citta as though it was a light or something that's like that. And he said, that's not the citta. He said, he shone his flashlight and he said, that's not the citta, eh? This is the citta. Yeah.
Oh, what is shown?
It's the one that it comes from.
Right.
In that case. And no one can say, the one who knows is the citta. The one who sees. The one who hears. Not what is heard. Not the reaction that comes to it either.
No.
The one who just knows it, and he just knows. It's not knowing knowing of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the hearing of any sound. It's not the seeing of any object.
Mm-hmm.
It's the hearing of just sound. It's the hearing of seeing of just colour. And the objects come about through comparison with memory, you know, at a later stage. I mean, it's very fast, but I mean, it is still a later stage. Comparison with memory, and then the identification, rightly or wrongly, is presented to the citta as it being this.
Yes, yes.
But the knowing, the first knowing that's there, that is just the citta.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an undefinable knowing. One can't even know it at that stage as seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or touching. It's just a sensation. That's all.
And now, in terms of the investigation, the Satipanya,
yeah.
It seems to me that the investigation of pain is crucial, whether it be physical pain or mental pain.
Yeah.
One key approach, it seems to me, from what you said, is that asking who is suffering or who is knowing the suffering.
Mm.
The task is separating the disidentifying, separating the painful sensation from myself.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Very important. Yes.
Mm.
But one has to realize also that in order for one to be able to do that, the citta must drop into a state of panya. In the ordinary consciousness, it can't do that. To get into that state of panya, one can do it by the investigation. One goes on and on and on to plug in it, and it can break through. Or it can do it by developing the samadhi, and there's another way around. Another direction.
You develop the samadhi independent from the pain that you're having?
Yes, if by one's practice of samadhi, one has developed it so that one can go into samadhi with a fair facility, then one can go into it with that problem of the pain coming up, and I can see quite quickly what the nature of it is.
Hmm. Ordinary consciousness doesn't seem to bother. It's passive if a pain is there.
Hmm.
I don't know whether I can drop in a state of panya very easily. I know that perhaps I can do the necessary preparation, wouldn't you say that asking repeatedly, you know, who's having the pain, where is the pain, is a way of preparing?
Yes, yes, it might. It might, yes. It might even break through it. Depends on how thick the barriers are. But Tana Chan has said that the citta is like a, something very bright and very clear, wrapped up by a lot of messy paper and all sorts of stuff. And because of that, you can't see it, you can't get it. And it's rather like this: when we can't get at the citta, we can't see the nature of things like pain and these sensations. We can't get the real nature. We can't see the difference between them and self. And what's necessary is to penetrate through.
In other words, yes, ways of not going away from the pain. I first of all, I think I need ways, I need to develop ways of sticking to the pain. Otherwise, how can I...
The key to that is sati.
The key is sati, yeah. Otherwise I drop away, I let it drop, let it drop away.
Yeah.
Whereas if I stick, you say stick to it, at least I have a chance, right?
Yeah.
I have no guarantee that I fall into the apanya state, but at least I have the necessary prerequisite if I stick to the pain, stick to the true sati.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So sati helps me hold, stick to it, and then panya, my understanding is that some is in my power, is in my hands, and some is not. Is that right? Is that correct? Something, there is something I can do in terms of panya, something which has to happen, I can't do it.
There's three things you can do, really. The first thing is to put forward effort. Second thing is to keep one's attention on it. And the third thing is to investigate. And if one keeps on doing those with enough strength, then it will break through. And the panya will rise.
Right. And when you say investigate, I remember what you were saying the other day. It's just this, in some way even creative, putting oneself on different angles, asking different questions, and besieging, so to speak, the pain or whatever it is being investigated.
Just constantly sort of attacking it from every angle like this, and going on and on and on with that until eventually something comes and breaks out and gets you.
But pain doesn't seem to be the only object of investigation, although prominent
many,
one.
Yes, many, yes.
Because it's the first
of the truth. In fact, it comes under the heading of the four satipatthanas. Kaya, Vedana, Chitta, Dhamma.
Yes, yes.
The four. Now, the first is body, which includes the body as it is, all its parts. Body as dead body or decaying body,
that's
seeing
right.
Loathsomeness, seeing it as the elements. I don't know if there are any other ways of seeing it, but I mean it's in all those ways there. And one can use any of these methods to see the body.
Yes.
And feeling, of course. Which would be way to know, it'd be the pain, that's where the other point comes.
Yes. And in case one wants to investigate body, I don't mean bodily pain, I mean body.
Yeah.
What would be a basic training? Like the five parts? Or?
They are the basic parikamma, yes. All the monks are given, the ordinations are given. They are important. And the method is again really looking at it, thinking about it, turning it over, trying to see what its real nature is. For example, if one's walking, you can look at the body and you look at the process of that. You can think about it, moving. And one can ask oneself, does this body know anything? Is this body able to decide anything? And the answer is, it doesn't know anything. Just like an old leather wood, a machine, you know that sort of.
In this case, you are investigating the body in its entire
in its entirety, or any way one likes, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You can take the parts if you like, and you can say, "Well, skin. Does the skin know anything? What is it? Is this something that's really me? I mean, what is this? I mean, this cut off here. This wouldn't immediately change. And yet how can I call it mine?" Things like that, and things. Trying to sort of break through and get the wisdom in that.
Or you can also select one part of the body, like a leg or hand. Or
yes. Whatever suits. Yes.
Again, it seems that one key question always has to do with me and myself.
Me and mine. Yes. Mm. Because we identify with them.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
And this identification is obviously a bad thing, because it brings us much dukkha. As the aim of Buddhism is the eradicating of dukkha, so the identification with body is contrary to the way of thinking.
Right.
And it's a false identification too. So, to the extent that the person can get free from the body, realizing it's not me, it's not mine, just part of this world, to that extent they lose the fear of death and the fear of injury to the body, the fear of harm to it. And they may still be afraid of pain, but the actual idea of loss where the body is concerned is minimized. So it's obviously a great gain.
Of losing the body, losing myself.
Or of part of the body even.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, to that extent, it's bound to be gained.
So
finding
ways of disidentifying oneself from the body. One of these ways can be the asupa meditations. But you say that some people.
The kāgatasati or asupa.
But some people are resistant to the asupa, right?
Oh, very resistant. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people will think for hours about the absolute, which they don't know anything about at all. The body, which they do know a lot about, they won't like to think about. Except in the wrong way.
Yeah, on the other hand, it's also, I remember reading Tanachan Mahabhuva, unattractiveness is a concept, useful one, but it's a concept, same as attractiveness, and the mind should go beyond both attractiveness and unattractiveness.
But in this case, the middle way is the balancing of the identification with body, balancing that against the asubha practice, to bring the citta to the middle way, which is seeing the truth. In other words, to see that the body is just part of this world. I mean, finally, it's no longer attractive or unattractive like an old bit of wood.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that.
You said something more specific. Balancing.
Yeah.
Against. Say,
balancing the attachment of the body,
mm-hmm.
or the attractiveness, the attraction to the body, against the asubha practice or the kāgatasati practice, because that's tending to go see the loathsomeness of the body rather than the attractiveness of it. So when one balances those two, then one comes to the centre and sees the truth.
Oh, I see what you mean. The middle way is not identifying with the attractiveness, neither with the attractiveness nor with the unattractiveness.
But to do that, you've got to go in the opposite to what one's natural inclination is. One's natural inclination is to identify with the body.
Is cherish the body.
And to cherish it and think it's beautiful or whatever it happens to be.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to go in the opposite direction
Which
to balance that out.
And this would be the useful side of the asupa meditation.
Yes. Yes.
So you see the unattractive side of the body.
One of the difficult things to realize, though, is how strong that attraction to the body is. Yeah, a person can only realize that when they start doing the practice and they try to see the body as being a super. They realize how strong it is and how, from that practice, one can get up often states of depression coming up. Because the chitta has been forced, or the self has been forced to see the unattractiveness. And this can, so a person doing that practice really needs to have some other practice as well to keep the chitta calm, like the anapana, calm down.
I guess also a fairly stable emotional quality.
Yes, if the person's fairly emotionally stable, it's all right. Somebody who's not emotionally stable might be in difficulty.
With this kind of practice,
could be.
Whenever, this is Tanachan again, an event, whether good or bad, makes contact with the mind, mindfulness and discernment, satipanya, should take it up immediately. Any event. We were talking about using the body to develop panya. But would you say that the body in certain respects is easier than other objects?
In general, I would say yes, it is, because it's more gross. Mm-hmm. After all, we have a fair idea of what it is. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we come to the feelings and the chitta, they're much more nebulous. Mm-hmm. Dhamma is even more so. So the advantage of the body is, well, yes, we've got a fair idea about this body. It may not be absolutely right, but still we start off with knowing quite a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it is easier to know.
Well, once we work enough with the body in our practice, then it is easier, I gather, to jump at any event, as Tanachan is pointing out. Event is anything.
Yes, although that is more general, what's there. As far as the body practice is concerned, they say that one who practices the body and is mindful of the body and knows the body, they never forget the body. Hmm. And they never forget themselves. Whatever circumstances they are, which means that they would have, they would keep their knowledge of themselves actively there. Whereas most people don't. They forget themselves and their minds wander off on themselves. Mm-hmm. And you only need to look at a group of people in a cocktail party. How many of them are there? Mm-hmm. They're thinking, talking about something else. Why is it all over the place? And forget their existence.
So you're saying that if one is grounded in the body, then this jumping, so to speak, at any event is
it
easier.
It becomes much more clear when it's done, when that happens, yes. It becomes very clear. And then one starts seeing how much everybody else is doing, because you can see it now. You come to see how everybody else is doing.
How little.
I know how much they're jumping about. Mm-hmm. How much they don't keep in the body. How much their minds are all over the place.
Yes, but I said jumping at any event in a positive sense. Whenever an event makes contact with the mind, mindfulness should take it up immediately. This is positive.
Yes.
In a positive way.
With that, the thing is, I'm not sure what the context of that is, but if it was in terms of body contemplation, it would probably mean that the mind is present here in the body, it keeps to the body due to the practice of that. Being present in the body, it becomes aware of what's going on around it very easily.
It becomes aware?
Of what's happening locally around the world. And it keeps to that. Therefore, it can very easily become aware when anything happens, whatever it is.
which means that mental events are more easily graspable if you are grounded in the body.
Yes, yes.
So you don't get sucked in Vedanas, or you are not forgetful.
Yeah. Yes.
So basically, you have much more sati pani.
It helps sati enormously. Mm-hmm. And it puts what I would call a different philosophy on life, different outlook on life. I mean, for example, one thinks you hear about an accident and 200 people have been killed or something of that sort. Now one thinks, well, these are just bodies. And if we work out just plainly by statistics, the average number of people dying per day is about 200,000 in the world. So we think, well, 200 people die there, really compared to the world, isn't very much, just enormous. I don't mean that we want accidents, but at the same time, one has to put in the picture, see it in perspective, and realize these are bodies as they're dying. And they're not people. They're what we colloquially call people. But the idea of there being a person there isn't really true.
In other words, what we think of people,
the way we think of people as people, is the wrong idea.
Oh, I see. In other words, we identify people with their bodies.
Yes.
And whereas you are saying a jump in or a change in philosophy.
Yeah. Completely new idea comes up. Because if you think, how do we identify people? By body, by bodily intimation, which means the movements of the body, and by speech. There's little else we know, really. So that is our identification. We identify people then by what we've seen and heard. And what else we build up is really in ourselves. We build up the image in ourselves.
Of that person.
Yes. Mm-hmm.